This is our in-depth section where we take a deep look into the topic at hand. Now we're going to take a look at a technology called blockchain and why Israel is a hotspot for that. Now in the past few years, Israel, driven by its military complex and its military industry, has become a hub for startups and innovation, especially with the two technologies that I mentioned, blockchain and fintech. Now blockchain, in case you don't know, is the same technology that is behind the digital currency Bitcoin. Do you see the money connection? You're going to find out why I'm mentioning that in a few minutes. Now let's move on to another reason for Israeli companies to want to expand in this field. Israeli blockchain companies are after what's called faster settlement times and larger transaction sizes of digital assets. Okay, that's very important. Moving on to another reason for its appeal, by establishing a decentralized ledger like for Bitcoin, blockchain technology could facilitate faster payments and larger transaction sizes of digital assets. Okay, so obviously you can see the appeal there.
Things that we do as a central bank, our role in the payments industry, the group that I lead, payments department, include establishing policy, kind of long-term policy for the payments landscape in the country, overseeing payment systems, operating payment systems, which are two very different things. We'll get into that in a minute. The payment systems that we operate are RTGS and the National Check Clearinghouse, as well as influencing and partnering with other government agencies and the operations part of the central bank to convert ourselves into a catalyst for adopting digital payments, because as government and as a central bank, we are able to influence consumer behavior deeply. So we take that role seriously as well.
Now, taking a look at fintech, it refers to the integration of technology into offerings by financial services companies. But this is what's important. Fintech expansion by Israel has lured foreign banks to Israel. So you can see that that is paying off again. Looking at the money connection.
Once that customer walked into the shoe store and tried to make a payment with the card, her connection with her bank is with the bank that issued her credit card. The store's connection is with the acquirer that processes the card transactions for the store. But they need to connect. They connect by sending each other data messages, transaction authorization requests, clearing, and then ultimately they also settle funds between them. It is that connection between the payment service providers, this yellow arrow in the middle, which actually comprises the payment system.
And all of this interest for Israeli companies and startups, well, it shows how Israel has influence over the financial payment system when it comes to, for example, banks. Now, when you take a look at that, just what I pointed out, this poses this question. Doesn't this give Israel more control or influence over these large financial groups? That is the key question, which obviously is the underlying reason behind Israel's penetration into this market.
Suenan los tambores de guerra.
Occupy Wall Street, OWS. It was an event that took place 10 years ago. Back then, hundreds of protesters took over Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan. They marched toward the financial district and voiced their anger at Wall Street firms and hedge funds that they controlled the U.S.
What kind of power?
People power!
Wall Street, it crashes, and people starve, people lose their jobs, things like that. We're very angry at Wall Street. It's part of capitalism, American capitalism especially. That's why we're here today at Wall Street.
The movement would last 59 days, but its ripple effects are still being felt. However, there was another side to the story. The protesters were also angry at the CEOs of some of these conglomerates.
Patricia McAllister, I'm here representing myself, but I do work for the Los Angeles Unified School District. And I think that the Zionist Jews who are running these big banks in our Federal Reserve, which is not run by the federal government, they need to be run out of this country.
These anti-Israeli sentiments were views held by the American and general public for a very long time. Their anger was directed not only at the firms, but also the CEOs. Here are some examples. The general view is that these Wall Street firms and their CEOs, and their greed in particular, were blamed for inequality and political corruption. They were also blasted for the special attention that they received during the 2008 financial crisis. The too big to fail was the government term used for bailing out some of these firms along with their CEOs.
U.S. influence, or by some accounts, control over the U.S., is not new news, by Israel, that is. But how does Israel exert control over the U.S., and more importantly, why does the U.S. allow this to happen? Let's take the U.S. Central Bank, or the Fed, as an example. New York Federal Reserve System is the name of the central bank of the U.S. It plays a leadership role in monetary policy, financial supervision, and the payments system of the U.S. By definition, control is exercised only by a board of governors, a member of which is a public servant, as they call it, that's appointed to his or her position by the President of the United States and confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Well, let's take a look at the appointments of high-ranking officials at the Fed, current and past. You have the current New York Fed Chair, Janet Yellen. You have Ben Bernanke, William Dudley, and Lee Bollinger. They all held top positions at the Fed, from the chairman to vice chairman. All right, rejoining us in this segment is Rodney Martin, and we also have Allison Weir, executive director of If Americans Knew, rejoining us. Rodney, my last question goes to you here. There's a perception about the Fed that is dominated and controlled, influenced somewhat by Israel. Some have even gone as far as saying that the money power that rules the world today, in another respect, is centered at the hands of a few individuals. Are there any truths to these?
Well, there is pertinent source, and that came from none other than Meyer Rothschild, who said, "Permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who makes the laws." There you have it in and of itself. And of course, the Rothschilds have been a very powerful Jewish banking family for centuries. And as far as a Federal Reserve, one need only look at three of the immediate past Federal Reserve chairmen, all of which shared something in common with Meyer Rothschild. And this has created some significant problems within society, particularly in minority communities in the United States, as more and more minorities fall more and more prey to very, very predatory banking practices.
Okay, well, Allison, one of the things that has always been said and has become obvious is how Israel influences U.S. officials up to the top positions, and that is the U.S. presidents. Again, for Israel to influence decision-making policies by the U.S. president. Even U.S. presidential candidates, when they're running, they need to woo the Israeli vote. Is it a fact that Israel, therefore, can influence the U.S., the White House, or the U.S. president's decision-making?
Well, again, this is a significant fact, but it's certainly much more nuanced than people might think. I have written about the Israel lobby quite a bit, because my focus is on Israel-Palestine, and it's very important to know what's driving U.S. policies. And I have consistently found that it is the Israel lobby that has driven our policies from the very beginning. And the Israel lobby largely consists of Jewish individuals and organizations. It also consists of others, but I'd say that's the group that dominates the Israel lobby.
Okay, we appreciate that. That is Allison Weather, Executive Director of If Americans Knew. Well, the point that Allison made there about the Israeli lobby is very significant. The Israeli lobby that she's talking about is very dominant. And what she is referring to there is AIPAC. And in particular, what is prevalent there is that U.S. lawmakers have to actually pledge their allegiance to Israel with conditions attached, as you're about to say. Next up, a look at one of the most influential families in the world, namely the Rothschilds. They have been behind many investments during their time, which is a window into how they exerted their power and influence in different business sectors. But what better way to tell you about this family than to introduce our new addition to the ED family, Matthew.
Our focus here is a family called the Rothschilds, a familiar name to many people. They are a wealthy family originally from Germany. They have been accused of secretly controlling the world economy and profiting from wars. The Rothschilds were the dominant power in European investment banking, which controlled 50% of the world's wealth. In 1823, it was reported that they took control over the financial operations of the Catholic Church worldwide. Through J.P. Morgan, among others, the Rothschilds took control of the banking industry in New York and therefore the U.S. Some of the other investments are Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company, Edward Harriman Railroad Empire, and Andrew Carnegie's Steel Empire. Rothschild's banks were also known to finance railway systems around the world. They financed the construction of the Suez Canal in Egypt, and they provided the capital for De Beers in 1888, which is the largest diamond mining company in the world. In 1987, Edmond de Rothschild created the World Conservation Bank to gain control of land in third world countries. The bank assumes the debts of these countries in exchange for real estate that is conveyed to the bank. In 1913, the Rothschilds established their last and current central bank in America, the Federal Reserve Bank. This independent bank regulates and controls America's money supply and monetary policies. Talking about central banks, it's interesting to note here that by 2001, only seven nations in the world, including China, Iran, Afghanistan, North Korea, Sudan, Cuba, and Libya, did not have Rothschild-controlled central banks. By 1995, the Rothschilds controlled an estimated 80% of the world's uranium reserves, thereby giving the family a monopoly over the nuclear power. The modern-day Rothschilds family, however, is said not to have the same wealth and influence as before. One reason is that they have produced hundreds of descendants and there is no longer any centralized family wealth. However, they are known as the wealthiest family in history to have a collective net worth of $400 billion as of 2021. Please send us your comments. We do appreciate them.
The partnership between ADL and PayPal. Yes, there are good incentives there. I mean, ADL claims it is after cutting off the hands, the financial hands of extremist groups and hate, at least in their eyes. That is a good thing. But here's, well, where the double standard is. If that is our aim, then what about the money that Israel has sent to assassins who have assassinated people in other countries, like in multiple cases of Iranian nuclear scientists? Or what about money that is sent to Israel from the U.S. to expand settlement activities, which the U.S. classifies as charity money sent to Israel? Now, these are acts that are clearly against international law. Where's PayPal and ADL there? Something to think about, isn't it? That is for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions or comments are always welcome. For me, Kavitafi, and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. According to a climate scorecard published in August, over the last 5 years, the top 100 ranked law firms in the United States facilitated $1.36 trillion of fossil fuel transactions, represented fossil fuel clients in 358 legal cases, and received $35 million in compensation for their work to assist fossil fuel industry lobbying. We now present you an article written by Isabella Kaminsky. The piece is titled U.S. Fossil Fuel Companies Paying Top Law Firms Millions to Dodge Responsibility. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. The world's biggest corporate law firms have been making millions of dollars representing fossil fuel companies, but as the climate crisis intensifies, this work is coming under increasing scrutiny. According to a climate scorecard published in August, over the last 5 years, the top 100 ranked law firms in the United States facilitated $1.36 trillion of fossil fuel transactions, represented fossil fuel clients in 358 legal cases, and received $35 million in compensation for their work to assist fossil fuel industry lobbying. Tim Herschel Burns, a third-year student at Yale Law School and co-founder of Law Students for Climate Accountability, which developed the scorecard, said, "The scale of the law firm's work for the fossil fuel industry is huge." He added, "As we started digging, we realized how holistic this is. Everything fossil fuel companies want to do, they need lawyers to accomplish." Fossil fuel companies rely heavily on armies of lawyers to advise on projects, lobby, negotiate contracts, secure permits, and navigate an increasing number of climate lawsuits. Law firms' fossil fuel industry work has increased compared with the previous year's scorecard, even as climate warnings become more dire and the International Energy Agency, the IEA, has warned new fossil fuel development is incompatible with the target of net zero emissions by 2050. The climate scorecard awarded firms grades based on their involvement in lawsuits exacerbating climate change, their support for fossil fuel transactions, and fees received for lobbying on behalf of the fossil fuel industry. Paul Weiss, a top 10 U.S. firm according to VaultLaw's rankings, was one of the 37 to receive the lowest F grade. According to the scorecard, the firm, which has its own sustainability practice, has acted for fossil fuel companies in 30 cases over the last 5 years. Among the most high profile was the firm's work representing ExxonMobil in a landmark trial where the company was accused of having misled investors about the risks of climate change to its business. The court ruled in favor of ExxonMobil in 2019. Paul Weiss did not respond to a request for comment. Only 12 law firms were rated A or B in the scorecard, which meant they did not conduct work for fossil fuel clients. According to the scorecard report, three firms, Cooley, Wilson Sonsini Goodrich and Rosati, and Shorter Roth and Zabel, have actively addressed the climate crisis through renewable energy transactions, lobbying, or pro-climate litigation. Tim Herschel Burns said, "We definitely agree that the law can be this force for good. But one thing that we found really striking is that overwhelmingly the top law firms are representing the wrong side of it." Alyssa Joel, legal director for the Center for Climate Integrity, said, "There is a tangible human cost." Alyssa Joel added, "Elite law firms are representing the oil and gas companies and providing them with a deep bench of high-priced lawyers." She said, "For the communities across the country that are seeking justice, the end result is that their cases have been delayed and bogged down by procedural hurdles put forward by some of the biggest law firms in the country." Law Students for Climate Accountability is calling on law firms to pledge to stop taking on new fossil fuel industry work, phase out their current work by 2025, and ramp up their work for the renewable energy industry and in support of litigation to tackle the climate crisis. It's a potentially controversial stance given the principle that everyone should have access to legal representation. But Tim Herschel Burns said, "This principle is often used in really sloppy ways which end up justifying law firms being able to represent whoever pays the most." Some firms have acknowledged the choice. Speaking at a conference last year about the link between law and climate change, the global senior partner at Clifford Chance Jeroen Urnhand said, "Firms can choose what we support and what we don't support. We do not have to be neutral professional service providers." Law firms are starting to ramp up their own climate action, even as they continue their fossil fuel work. A number of firms that scored F grades on the climate scorecard, including Shearman & Sterling and Hogan Lovells, have signed up to the Net Zero Lawyers Alliance, which launched in July. Members pledge to achieve net zero emissions by 2050 and to work with clients to embed climate goals and to help drive systematic change. Neither firm responded to The Guardian's request for comment. Another alliance member, DLA Piper, has set its own science-based target to halve all emissions by 2030, including indirect emissions from the firm's supply chain. The firm was recently appointed official legal service provider for the forthcoming COP26 climate talks in Glasgow, but it scored only a D on the climate scorecard and has represented clients including Shell, ExxonMobil, and BP. The firm declined to comment. Tom Wetzer, a law professor and director of the Oxford Sustainable Law Program, one of the organizations supporting the alliance, said, "The firms may be serious about taking steps in the right direction, but they do not necessarily have the best practices as yet." Tom Wetzer added, "We need to move the whole sector, and for many firms involved, this is the start of a long journey." Some law firms that ranked low on the climate scorecard were keen to promote their green energy work. Allen & Overy, which according to the scorecard worked on fossil fuel transactions worth $125 billion over the last 5 years, claimed in a statement that it does more renewable work than any other law firm in the world by most key measures. Clifford Chance, which the scorecard calculated worked on fossil fuel transactions worth $123 billion, said it is perennially at or near the top for advising on renewable financing. But neither firm, both of which scored an F, responded to questions about how they reconcile their work with their representation of fossil fuel firms. Tom Wetzer said lawyers have a responsibility to reflect on their own role and to ask whether their clients' values align with their own. He added, firms that engage constructively with a net zero transition will be rewarded. Clients will value their judgment and expertise. Top talent will be more easily attracted and retained, and these firms will strengthen their social license to operate. Sam Sankar of the non-profit environmental law organization Earth Justice, which makes the climate scorecard a powerful tool, said law firms' best resource is their employees. Adding, in the future, nobody is going to think twice about making career decisions with an eye to whether it aligns with their climate ethics. Sam Sankar said, there is now a conversation about legal ethics and climate, which is well overdue. Adding, the fossil fuel industry is paying law firms tons of money in an effort to dodge responsibility and block regulatory reforms that could help avert this crisis.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In another sign of growing tensions in ties between Washington and Beijing, the United States Central Intelligence Agency announced the formation of a group that would focus exclusively on China. The CIA argued in a statement that the China Mission Center aims at addressing what it called global challenges to the U.S. competitiveness posed by the People's Republic of China. According to the U.S. spy agency, those issues include emerging technologies, economic security, climate change, and health.
The real threat that China poses that the United States is referring to is the ability to undermine the empire. And when we see that right now, that there's definitely a global shift going on, which is starting to move from the West towards the East, of which China is the main power in this situation.
The announcement comes amid a wider prioritization by the administration of President Joe Biden on countering Beijing. In June, Biden announced a new task force at the Pentagon to assess and respond to Beijing's military challenge. The United States and China remain at odds over several issues, including the situation in Hong Kong, U.S. relations with Taiwan, trade, commerce, and the disputed South China Sea. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In the case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing. Top U.S. counterintelligence officials have reportedly warned that a concerning number of CIA informants are being captured and executed. According to the New York Times, the warning came in a top-secret memo the officials issued to all of the CIA stations and bases around the world last week. The memo suggests that the agency's counterintelligence mission center looked at dozens of cases in the last several years involving foreign informants who had been killed, arrested, or most likely compromised. The cable itself was not necessarily unique, but as the Times notes, announcing the specific number of killings is rare, as the information is usually kept strictly under wraps by intelligence officials.
And this has been something that was significant enough that it was leaked into the mainstream media where it was reported on. It seems the United States sees this as possibly a potential crisis and something they need to reinforce with more bodies.
According to the Times, recruiting spies has always been highly risky. However, the cable warned that the CIA has not excelled in the area recently for reasons that include being too trusting of sources, underestimating foreign intelligence agencies, and moving too quickly to recruit informants while ignoring potential risks.
It's frankly acknowledged that everybody is spying on everybody else because everybody needs to know what their competitor is doing with regards to their stance towards them and what plans they have, etc. So in this regards, the United States is not doing anything new, nothing that it has ever done before. But the main bulwark of this, the main reason this is happening, is the U.S. is trying to expand its current intelligence network.
The report says that the uptick in the compromised informants highlights the growing prowess of other countries in employing innovations like biometric scans, facial recognition, artificial intelligence, and hacking tools to track the movements of CIA officers in order to discover the sources. The memo suggested that the U.S. spy agency overestimated its capacities and underestimated its adversaries. The results show that countries targeted by U.S. espionage are becoming more capable of exposing agents than ever before.
U.S. social media giant has come under a scathing attack by a former employee. The company has been accused of putting profit over everything else. Former Facebook employee Frances Hogan says that the company's sites and apps are harmful for children. She's also accused the social media platform of stoking divisions in society. 37-year-old Hogan was previously a product manager at the company. Now she's a whistleblower and has turned against Facebook. She made the accusation at a hearing in the Senate. Hogan accused Facebook of putting profit over safety and compared it to tobacco companies, arguing that a company with such frightening influence over so many people, over their deepest thoughts, feelings, and behavior, needs real oversight. She also said that if left alone, Facebook will continue to make choices that go against the common good.
If you look at the way that they filter content, if you look at the way that they censor certain topics that they'd rather not be seen, the way that they quote-unquote fact-check some of the things, the way that they delete accounts without discretion, the way that they censor people, and the way that they choose what content goes at the top of your newsfeed or shows up on your newsfeed at all through their algorithm, they really have a grip on what it is we are able to see on Facebook.
The context for the hearing were materials that she had leaked to the Wall Street Journal. According to the documents, Facebook's own studies suggest that Instagram and social media in general have a negative psychological effect on young girls. She also accused Facebook's CEO Zuckerberg of having too much power and bringing up the January 6th Capitol riot.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal.
Facebook has faced growing scrutiny and increasing calls for its regulation. Founder Mark Zuckerberg hit back, saying the latest accusations were at odds with the company's goals. In a letter to the staff, he said that many of the claims were illogical and pointed to Facebook's efforts to fight harmful content. The CEO argued that while Facebook took the initiative to create a massive research project to identify and solve certain problems, critics are merely weaponizing that work against the company to create a false narrative. Responding to Hogan's claims that Facebook's attempts to limit harmful content were constantly hampered by a shortage of staff, he said, "If we did not care about fighting harmful content, then why would we employ so many more people dedicated to this than any other company in our space, even ones larger than us?" Facebook is the world's most popular social media site. The company says it has 2.7 billion monthly active users.
So I think overall it's very detrimental to democracy because of the flow of information that is so tightly controlled through Facebook. And also think it shows, much like tobacco companies in the past or vape companies, that they've targeted children who are in very crucial developmental stages in their lives in order to get new customers, as noted in the testimony before the Senate.
Hundreds of millions of people also use the company's other products, including WhatsApp and Instagram, but it has been criticized on several fronts, from failing to protect users' privacy to not doing enough to halt the spread of disinformation.
Facebook, as I said, can truly decide what shows up in your newsfeed, what gets attention, what is put in the spotlight, and what is suppressed. And I think that's a big problem. It doesn't matter who you're friends with or who you like or the groups you're in, etc. They can filter stuff out through including certain ads. They can bury stuff in their algorithms. They can ban or censor or suspend accounts that may or may not go against the terms of service. Sometimes it's not so clear whether or not certain users go against terms of service, but find themselves banned or suspended anyway.
The accusations against the social media giant came amid a worldwide outage of the company's platforms. The social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. The global outage and the revelations seriously harmed the media giant's status in the world as a reliable media platform.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, led by the United States, has long been on a confrontational course with Russia. Developments on the ground on Russia's western borders and elsewhere are pointing to increasing tensions between the two sides. The Western Alliance has been moving military hardware and ground forces to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. The situation in Ukraine has turned into another serious bone of contention. NATO and Russia have been flexing their military muscles. The two have shown through their military drills and deployments, as well as public statements, that they are serious about pursuing their geopolitical interests in the Baltic region, the Middle East, and even in the Arctic. Meanwhile, America's ongoing efforts to complete a comprehensive missile system in Europe have further worried Moscow. Radars, warships, and long-range missile interceptors placed across Europe form components of the controversial system.
Without the Soviet Union, NATO does not need to exist, and they are clinging for dear life. They're trying to justify, to create a reason for them to be there and to continue to exist, and that's why they're constantly provoking Russia when Russia is not the Soviet Union. They are not the threat that the Soviet Union was.
As NATO expands eastward, Russia is not sitting idly by. It has adopted a set of countermeasures. For instance, Russia has used its westernmost territory, Kaliningrad, as a platform to boost its defenses. The territory is located between Poland and Lithuania on the Baltic Sea. Moscow has deployed the Iskander missiles and its S-400 air defense systems in Kaliningrad. NATO and Moscow have maintained contacts to try to minimize risks. The Russian Federation has had an observer mission to the Western Alliance. It was meant to promote cooperation in common security areas. This week, tensions between the two sides escalated once again after NATO expelled some members of the Russian mission. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that the organization expelled the 8 Russian diplomats over a rise in, quote, malign activities by Moscow. The Russian government was quick to slam NATO's decision. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that there is an obvious inconsistency and statements by NATO representatives about their desire to normalize relations with Russia and in their actual actions. He added that such actions allow Moscow not to develop illusions about the normalization of relations. Meanwhile, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the lower house of the Russian parliament, Leonid Slutsky, warned of asymmetric retaliatory measures. How will this latest episode of tensions between the two sides play out? NATO's relations with Moscow have largely been tied to the policies of the United States. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was usually accused of being too soft on Russia, but Joe Biden has made it clear that his administration will be tough on Moscow. In his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed two new sets of sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden has repeated accusations of interference in U.S. elections and cyber attacks on government and businesses against Russia. Washington and Moscow are also locked in a dispute over embassy staffing, which could further sour their ties. Analysts believe that the rivalry between the Russian Federation and the West, including NATO, is too deep-rooted to be solved in any foreseeable future.
The biggest ever data leak in history has exposed hidden offshore assets worth millions of dollars, allegedly tied to 35 current and former world leaders and more than 300 other public officials from over 90 countries. Nearly 3 terabytes of data, dubbed the Pandora Papers, were leaked to the Washington-based International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Over 600 journalists helped review 12 million documents leaked from 14 financial services companies. Jordan's King Abdullah, a close U.S. ally, was reported to have used offshore accounts to spend more than $100 million on luxury homes in the United Kingdom and the United States. The papers also accused the family and close associates of Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev of corruption, suggesting that they've traded close to £400 million in UK property over the past 15 years through a network of offshore firms. The papers have also implicated the Czech Prime Minister, presidents of Ukraine, Cyprus, Kenya, and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, among other high-profile figures.
Because people don't want to solve it. It's very simple. I mean, first of all, bear in mind the central banks around the globe have opened up their money spigots to extraordinary levels since the 2008 financial crisis. So as a result, you have tons and tons and tons of capital circulating around the world, unregulated, looking for the highest profit levels, etc. And the banking sectors are making lots and lots of money over this.
While having offshore firms and accounts isn't illegal, the papers allege that some of the companies have helped officials hide their wealth, practically enabling them to evade paying taxes, while some others have used them for money laundering and other fraudulent financial schemes. According to the Pandora Papers, over a dozen U.S. states are providing financial secrecy services that rival those of offshore tax havens in Europe and the Caribbean region. The documents single out South Dakota, which has allegedly sheltered billions of dollars in assets linked to people previously accused of financial crimes. The investigation says South Dakota state lawmakers have adopted lax regulations drafted by trust industry insiders. Measures that have quadrupled customers' trust in the state compared to 10 years ago. Some of the trusts cited in the probe are linked to people accused of human rights and labor abuses. The revelations come despite President Joe Biden's pledge that Washington will lead the efforts internationally to promote financial transparency and fight against corruption.
Now, the U.S., for example, talks about equalizing tax rates, shutting down tax havens, et cetera, but in fact, individual U.S. states have been opening their doors wider and wider to these kinds of activities. South Dakota is one example, Nevada is another, and a third is Delaware, a small state on the East Coast, which is home to Joe Biden. And Joe Biden's history, he essentially is a product of this anything goes, hot money, corporate culture.
The rich and powerful people cited in the large-scale investigation have already begun to deny wrongdoings and in some cases express readiness to undergo scrutiny. What's for certain is that they have a lot to answer for in their respective countries for the months or even years to come.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Fears that the United Kingdom is heading for a trade war with the European Union have been fueled by strong indications from the British government that proposals to be unveiled in Brussels on Wednesday, 13th of October, over Brexit arrangements do not go far enough. The Brexit Minister, Lord Frost, will use a speech in Portugal on Tuesday, 12th of October, to say that the scrapping its prohibition on British sausages to resolve the dispute over the Northern Ireland Protocol do not meet Britain and Unionist demands. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's Brexit correspondent Lisa O'Carroll. The piece is titled, Trade War Looms as UK Set to Spurn EU Offer on Northern Ireland. Fears that Britain is heading for a trade war with the European Union have been fueled by strong indications from the British government that proposals to be unveiled in Brussels on Wednesday, 13th of October, over Brexit arrangements do not go far enough. The Brexit Minister, Lord Frost, will use a speech in Portugal on Tuesday, 12th of October, to say that scrapping its prohibition on British sausages to resolve the dispute over the Northern Ireland Protocol do not meet Britain and Unionist demands. The peer will call for significant changes to the post-Brexit agreement he negotiated, including over the role of the European Court of Justice, something the European Union is highly unlikely to concede to. Without new arrangements in this area, the protocol will never have the support it needs to survive. It will warn on the eve of a significant move by the European Union to resolve the row. Meanwhile, Ireland's Foreign Minister Simon Coveney reacted with incredulity at Britain's red line and its timing just days before what he said was a serious offer from the European Union. Simon Coveney tweeted, EU working seriously to resolve practical issues with implementation of protocol. so the British government creates a new red line barrier to progress. That they know the European Union can't move on. Are we surprised? But the real question is, does the British government actually want an agreed way forward or a further breakdown in relations? The European Union's Brexit Commissioner, Maroš Šefčovič, will table four papers on Wednesday on the subject of how the Northern Ireland Protocol can be improved, which he has described as very far-reaching. Included will be a proposed national identity exemption for British sausages from the EU's prohibition on prepared meat from a third country, sources have confirmed. But Mojtaba Rahman, the managing director of the Eurasia Group consultancy, warned in a note to clients on Saturday that the absence of concessions on the European Court of Justice will give Lord Frost the justification for triggering Article 16, the mechanism for putting the Northern Ireland Protocol into formal dispute process or putting it into abeyance by disapplying the arrangements altogether. There is a huge amount of cynicism in the European Union about what the British government's actual objectives are. Is it to fix substantive issues in Northern Ireland, or is it to keep an ideological fight with the European Union rolling because it serves certain sections of the Tory party, said Rahman. The French president and the German chancellor and the European Commission president cannot wake up every single day to a new argument with Boris Johnson. At some point, they need to send a stronger, simpler message. The use of a termination clause within the trade and cooperation agreement itself can be triggered unilaterally and would fully suspend the zero-tariff, zero-quota trade deal between the two sides. This cross-retaliation mechanism, allowing trade penalties for breaches of the withdrawal agreement, was agreed by both sides. But others think the European Union will not be so keen to go nuclear. Catherine Barnard, professor of European Union law at University of Cambridge, believes short, sharp shocks in the form of tariffs on iconic British products such as Scottish whisky or Scottish salmon are more likely. She also said that the European Court of Justice is not a significant issue in relation to the trade of goods. Its annual report cites just 24 cases relating to customs union laws currently pending, among more than 1,045 cases in total. Lord Frost also told delegates at the Conservative Party conference last week that the rules required the European Union to be proportionate, but said he'd still hope to come out of negotiations with a fresh deal. Retaliatory measures are unlikely until next year, with the European Union expected to respond with infringement and legal proceedings as its first response to any suspension of the Northern Ireland Protocol by Britain. Northern Ireland Protocol, designed to avoid a hard border between the United Kingdom and the single market operating in the Republic of Ireland, placed the border in the Irish Sea, enraging unionists in Northern Ireland who see checks on goods coming into Northern Ireland from Britain as an attack on the integrity of the UK and their British identity. The European Union is expected to propose eliminating checks on goods destined to remain in Northern Ireland, with checks only on those products that are intended for sale in the Irish Republic. Both sides have said they expect to go into a period of intense negotiations, which Lord Frost put at 3 weeks after the EU's response to the UK's demands are published on Wednesday. But one school of thought is that Frost and the Home Secretary Priti Patel are being used to keep the Brexit pot boiling to show how the UK is sticking up against EU bullies. Others think the fight over Northern Ireland protocol is more fundamental. One former Downing Street official said he had been told Boris Johnson was going round telling people he had been misled over the protocol and was determined it would have to be rewritten. Frost will say on Tuesday that Britain-EU relationship is under strain, but if the two sides can put the protocol on a durable footing, we have the opportunity to move past the difficulties of the past year.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Yemenis have held an event in front of the As-Sala al-Kubra community hall in Yemen's capital Sana'a to commemorate the fifth anniversary of a massacre committed by the Saudi-led coalition in 2016. Participants condemned the international silence toward this brutal crime, saying when it comes to Yemen, the West continues to show its double standards. Abdusalam Amir is one of those who were present during the attack, where he got injured.
On that day, the sheikhs of the Nihim tribe and I attended to offer condolences to the Al-Ruwaishan family because of our relationship with them. I was sitting there when the unexpected happened, a terrorist crime that killed and injured more than 700 of the best men of Yemen. This criminal act does not differ from the terrorist operations carried out by the coalition of aggression in all cities of Yemen over the past years, and the source of all these crimes is the extremist Wahhabi ideology led by the House of Saud.
On October 8, 2016, Saudi warplanes targeted the As-Sala al-Kubra community hall in Sana'a with at least two air-dropped munitions during a funeral ceremony. Over 140 people were killed and more than 600 others were injured in the attack, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
People here say the bombing of the funeral ceremony at the As-Sala al-Kubra community hall revealed the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition against Yemenis. They say Riyadh's crimes will never be forgotten and Saudi Arabia should be brought to justice for its crimes. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in the Syrian capital Damascus and met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. They discussed the military condition in Syrian soil. President Assad stressed that work will continue until liberating all Syrian territories from terrorism and ending foreign illegal presence. Talks also covered regional and international developments, including the situation in Afghanistan. Amir Abdullahian briefed President Assad on the Iranian nuclear file negotiations, expressing Iran's goal to achieve sustainable development. He said Iran wants to cooperate with its neighbors to break the economic siege on his country and neutralize sanctions imposed on the Iranians. Amir Abdullahian also underlined the importance of boosting economic cooperation with Syria.
In the past weeks, we reached important agreements for a full development of relations between both countries in all fields, as well as setting programs for implementing such cooperation agreements in economic, trade, and tourism sectors.
Amir Abdullahian also discussed with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maghdad recent developments, including the results of his talks with Lebanese and Russian officials related to the Syrian crisis. Maghdad expressed Syria's full support to Iran in its nuclear file.
Syria fully supports Iran in its efforts in the nuclear issue. We strongly condemn the U.S. moves aimed at manipulating Iran's nuclear program and other regional affairs.
This is the second visit for the top Iranian official to Syria in less than 2 months. His trip is part of an